Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yuggera, Turrbal and Yugrupul peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Kombamiri, Noonuckle, Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners, tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, blue sky and sunshine. Looked like there was going to be some rain last night, but no, it wasn't to be. It's blue sky and sunshine. But there was certainly a bit of a battering over the throughout the southeast here in the weekend due to the big storms we've had, and some big insurance claims taking place at the moment. Now, my guest today, talking to me from the Northern Territory, Dr. Bentley James. Bentley James is an anthropologist, a linguist, and a man with a passion and commitment to supporting the situation with First Nations people. Bentley, welcome to the program. How are you?
Good morning, Tiger. Yes, very well. Thank you, and hello to everybody.
Where exactly are you as we speak?
I'm in a place called Wootan, a shed in the backyard of my brother's house in Darwin, on my way out to the Crocodile Islands.
Whereabouts? Well, we'll get to the whereabouts of the Crocodile Islands in a little while, but you've been involved in the Northern Territory with First Nations people for some time. Down with the Walpri people at Yuendumu?
Yes, I remember meeting with you and Wayne Morton in Bachelor many years ago. We struggled for Indigenous broadcast rights back in the early 90s, and, of course, with wonderful Francis Kelly, whom I believe you had to speak to yesterday. How good.
Yes, live in the studio yesterday. It was just great to have Francis here, along with a few other people, but he was good to have him here. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah, well, I worked with Francis in Yuendumu for 3 years at the Walpri Media Association as a volunteer making children's programs in language to, as the old people in the day used to say, fight fire with fire, to tell the right story in the right language in the good way, and so to have an antidote against the lie story.
Yes, he mentioned that I think that was that was the principle of establishing the media, was fight fire with fire, was the message from his old people up there, eh?
Yes, old people said we don't want them chasing us into the desert with their nasty materialism and their greedy ideas. We want to be able to grow up the children on country in a good way, so they grow up learning their traditions and language and ways of being and being on the country good way.
This has obviously struck a chord with you. That principle, those values. Yeah?
Absolutely. Yes, I think the most valuable thing that Australia owns, if there's anything at all, is the wonderful natural cultural resources of our people and their language and their arts and their dance and their connections to each other and to the country and to a history that stretches back beyond memory, so far back to the very first ever journey by sea, the intercontinental journey to the southern continent 50,000 or more years ago, in which the first time ever people, you know, the fathers and mothers of all people, landed here in this wonderful place and began to learn the names and the stories of the place. And we are the lucky inheritors at this moment of that incredible legacy. So to me, there is nothing more valuable than that.
You mentioned the journey by our people. I imagine you're talking about our people some 50,000 years ago. Is that your belief, your understanding? Because I think it conflicts with a lot of my people's understanding that we don't believe we travel from anywhere by any means. We were created here.
I understand, and quite rightly too. Having been a student at the university, of course, we are given to believe in the stories that scientists tell us And that's the scientist's story.
Okay.
So certainly, Bemaranga, for example, the oldest and wisest lady I know, believes, of course, that the ancestors do come from the very essence of the sea and land, and that's certainly the most powerful and beautiful story I've ever heard.
Now, you've mentioned Laurie Bemaranga, 96-year-old Australian of the Year?
Yes, yes, Australian of the Year, Senior Australian of the Year. The Australian of the Year is the wonderful Geoffrey Rush, and he has been a wonderful supporter of Bemaranga's project.
And Bemaranga, she comes from Crocodile Island. She's you were telling me a story. She lives up there, but is a tradition, was recently recognised as the traditional owner for Gullawinku.
An interesting story, yes. Well, Bemaranga was born around 1919 on Murunga, largest of the outer Crocodile Islands, about 50 kilometres from the edge of Australia into the sea. And so, you know, beyond sight. And there, her and her family and kinsmen lived before the coming of the mission and the, you know, the period preceding our own era. And so many of the stories that came after that sort of forgot about her long-time ownership. For many years, she fought a battle with people to get recognition of her father's estate, where Gullawinku is now positioned, the mission that got there in the 1940s. And eventually she was recognised, and with the back payment of rent for 50 years, she got $400,000, and she immediately said, "I don't want the money. I only care for kin and country, and I'm going to give that money to community development projects, particularly the Crocodile Islands Rangers project that she started." And so she started the Crocodile Islands Ranger project to give children livelihood activities on country, learning their names, learning the places of the country, and having really interesting things to do that they'd like to do that are positive livelihood employment opportunities for them, and give a pathway for younger children growing up to follow.
So was that the beginnings of the dictionary of the Yanangu language?
Right, the Yanangu language. Actually, no. The Yanangu dictionary started a long time ago. In 1993, when I first met with Bemaranga at Murunga Island, I was speaking to her in the language that all of the people in northeast Arnhem Land in that corner called the Yulungu area speak, Yulungu Mata, or people's tongue. And that language is a language that about 7,000 people in that part of the world speak. But Bemaranga said, "Don't speak that language. That's not the language of the Crocodile Islands. You must learn to speak Yanangu. Yan means tongue and Nangu means this. So it's the language of here, of this place, of the Crocodile Islands." And so I went away to try and find out about Yanangu, and there was only 300 words of it written down anywhere. So together, her and I started to write down the words of the Yanangu language, which only has 15 speakers now. And we've put together a dictionary of some 3,600 words that link all of the 560 named sites in the seas and islands in 10,000 square kilometres of beautiful sea country to the people of the country and the animals and trees and plants and islands and phenomena of the world, and all of the knowledge that generations, thousands of generations of intimate coexistence with the environment have given to that older generation, and that she wants to pass on to the young people to give them a vision of the future that is healthy.
How did you meet Bemaranga?
I was working as a homelands teacher. In 1993 I met her, but before that I was living at Gullawinku as a teacher. So when I went out to meet Bemaranga in 1993, that's the dictionary work. And the dictionary then grew into other things like the Yanangu Ecological Database and the Language Nests project to teach young people their language first before they came in contact with the new language. So one of the things that the dictionary, for example, does is it is a bilingual, or in this case, trilingual learning resource. So kids can learn to speak Yanangal or Jambarpingal Gupapingal, which are the other two Dualduala languages of the Yulungu Mata language, and English, with a pronunciation guide and photographs of things online and in a dictionary, in the vacuum created by the removal of bilingual education by the government. So Bemaranga is working to make the dictionary free for all of the children on the homelands.
Any government support? Was there submissions there would have been submissions written for government support and funding and stuff to get this project going?
Yes, Tiger, as you probably also know, and most people do. For 25 years, we've been writing submissions for funding, and every year there's a fanfare about how much more there is to spend, and every year there is less and less. So this year, we got less than one-fifth of what we needed to create a trilingual dictionary to give to the children of the 500 or so homelands in the Northern Territory for free. There is apparently no money for that kind of thing.
So there's... Well, how do you feel as a mainstream Australian, a member of the settler society, when you can see the value of the culture, of the people, the ancient knowledge, and you're one of a small minority. I mean, there's a very few people of settler society recognise and value this. How do you feel?
You know, I feel really lucky. I think I'm one of the most fortunate people in the world. For the last 20 years, I have been able to spend my time every day with the most virtuous human being you could possibly imagine. This wonderful, wonderful lady is my mother's mother's mother. And one of the joys of learning an Indigenous language is learning about kinship. So my own mum's mum and mum have passed away, but in Murunga, on the Crocodile Islands, I stayed with my mother's mother's mother, a lady of enormous wisdom and incredible virtue and generosity and kindness. And she taught me about the world and all of the lovely things in the world. For example, how it is that everybody is related together. In this part of the world, there's a system of relationships that have about 72 different reciprocal kinship terms, but they are linked to a network of kinship relations that link all of the people and the country together and all of the things and phenomena and trees and plants together. So that if you know somebody is of your mother's mother's clan, for example, Bemaranga is my wako, mother's mother's clan, and the mother's 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 clan refers to me in a particular way, any of the animals or birds like the red-tailed cockatoo that they sing and paint and celebrate and care for, I know I can call them mother's mother's mother, and that they call me ngapapi or keke, and that we know how to behave toward each other and have a law and a way of acting with each other and with the rest of the world that is part of a way of living in the world that is thousands of generations old. And has a real beauty, a real artistry about it. Very, very fortunate. I'm the luckiest person I know. I'm so lucky.
You certainly are. You certainly are. Is it not? Would it not be a good thing then for the settler society to have a similar respect, understanding, valuing of First Nations people and culture and ancient knowledge? How do you feel about that?
Well, it's a very... absolutely, of course. Every wise woman's daughter knows that if you live in Australia, you drink its water and you have something to do with the elements of the country. It's dust, it's sands, it's winds, it's timings. We are all Australians, part of Australia in some elemental way. We're made of the same stuff that it is. And Indigenous Australians, of course, are the most fortunate people because they not only have this elemental attachment, but they have this wonderfully religious and profound attachment to place that goes back in time before we even knew how to map time. So that brilliant connectedness to place, that wonderful sense of really belonging, to have a reason to hear and know the sound of the cicadas in the morning or the crickets at night, to understand what they mean and to feel some kind of linkage with those beautiful things, is so beautiful. It would be a great thing for all Australians to be able to share in that most important and profoundly Australian thing, because all of the other imported things, of course, are, well, not Australian for a start, but secondly, are mostly these days, unfortunately, to do with big oil and, you know, sugar drinks and corporate greed and that materialist lifestyle.
Tell me about Crocodile Islands. You talk about Gullawinku. You spoke about the struggle for Baimawanga to establish her being recognised as a traditional owner, as Gullawinku being her homelands. Yet, and you talk about the Crocodile Islands, which is 50 kilometres off the coast. What's the connection here?
The wonderful thing about, and of course, everyone knows that the sea and the land are the same. So the same religious principles and also elemental, the same things that make up the sea and the land and the songs and the paintings and the country and the stories are in the sea as well as on the land. So in the Crocodile Islands, in 10,000 square kilometres of sea country, are named reef and named islands and named sites where all of the creation ancestors and their journeys go, where amazing things have happened and where you can go today, when the places you're allowed to go, of course, where there are amazing structures under the sea that you can actually see. Some of these things are really incredible, and many of them not to be seen, that are sacred. But unfortunately, of course, because it's the sea, the colonial society thinks that it owns it all, and has allowed fishermen to go through that area willy-nilly, dragging their nets across the seafloor. But the outer reefs go nearly 100 kilometres out, and they're all named, you know, they all have their names, Dukuwana Meringuli and Brulbrulnga and Larajaje. They're all named places with histories and stories where people went and where people cared for their environment. So this 30 islands, three outer islands, and the 27 inner Crocodile Islands also include Milangimbi, and on the far side of the Castlereagh Bay is Gullawinku, and they're part of the homelands of the Yanangu-speaking people. And they speak one variety of the Yulungu Matha, people's language of that area. But their long-term connection is with the sea area of that country. They had a system and pattern of yearly inter-island travel that followed the coming of the seasons and the return of the nesting birds and the seagulls and the jarak-jarak, all of the tiny birds that live on the outer islands, and the kujiji, the whistling ducks, who are starting to mate at the moment with the coming of the rain, and the different fish that come and go at different times of the year, and the patterns of turtle laying and dugong travel, and all of the resources of the forests on the islands that come to fruit at different times. So people would get in their canoes and paddle hundreds of kilometres by sea to different places where they would go and stay by fish traps, very ancient fish traps, and beautiful freshwater wells that provide the water that kept the people strong and make life a beautiful, rich and verdant, a fertile thing. So, they're all connected together. All the islands and the sea are connected.
It's amazing. You are a very fortunate man. My guest today is Dr. Bentley James. He is an anthropologist and a linguist and is working with Laurie Baimawanga, who is 96-year-old Senior Australian of the Year for 2012. And Bentley works with Baimawanga on the dictionary of the Yanangu language. which is a language of the people of the Crocodile Islands. Bentley Galawinku, they speak in that same language?
Well, traditionally, the Galawinku area would have used the language of Yanangu because all of the sites in the area are named in the language of the ancestors that made them. So as the ancestors went through that country, they transformed the landscape and the sea into these beautiful, and if you've ever been out that way, beautiful countries. And those countries contain an essential element, a little bit of those ancestral essences. With those essences comes the law and the language. So the named places are in the language of Yanangu. But everyone in that area, of course, is related, and people used to marry in wide connected kin-based groups. And that network of kin also included people speaking many different languages. So multilingualism, of course, is something we know in Australia to be every day. Yeah. Most Australian people were multilingual, and that great skill of being able to hear somebody else's language and start speaking it is also a very generous political statement that says, I see, hear, and respect the language of your ancestors, and I use your words to show my respect. A very, very thoughtful way of behaving. There's a way of singing songs as well that, of course, the boys from Off the India will know called Dake Gulpten, which means a cut, a taste of. So you might use the tune of another group when singing traditional songs just to signify to them just how much you respect your relationship to them, their country, and their ancestors and language. So there's lots of ways of being able to talk to people. So Galawinku had lots of languages that are used on it, as it does today, as does Milingimbi and many of the other communities around.
All right. The Yanangu Dictionary. This has to be one of the most important works, projects, ever to be undertaken up there.
Well, it's certainly the most important thing I've ever done. And being in the company of Bemaranga, I come to recognise just how important that is. It's really, really special to be able to go to places that are named, that have a history, that have a relationship that you know and you can understand and speak and then speak to other people about that kind of history. So to feel a sense of belonging in country that is perhaps a little bit more profound than many other groups know. For example, the idea of, you know, country and language coming from the same thing in anthropological speak is the idea of an ontology of site-based ontology. So the theory of knowing in existence coming from the site. And that idea is very, very strongly, uniquely Australian. It doesn't exist anywhere else in the world except very, very small places. So this huge continent is covered with sites with language that belong to people that are part of the people in a profound way. And it's the language of the country that is so important in knowing who and what you are and how to refer to each other and the things around you in a respectful and proper manner. So the dictionary, in some ways, attempts to show everybody that this is a real way of living in the world, that is a vision of the future that is more inclusive and is less, say, narrowed and materialist and more about accepting all of the differences that people have and being aware of what's going in particular locations, how to live sustainably in a location. That's perhaps also how the Ranger Program grows out of the dictionary, because the Ranger Program is about providing livelihood activities for young people and positive engagement with country. But at the same time, they get to travel to and learn the names of their country and the language of their country. And so they have histories and experiences on country that become part of their life story. And they tell that life story to their children. And their children's children grow up with a path to follow, a path that is about looking after the world, about living sustainably and living in a world that has a law already in place, a law that has been here since a long time ago. So that's probably where the Ranger program and the dictionary are growing from the same root. They're both about looking after the language and essences of country. So that's a strong link. I mean, Bainwanga is very, very firm on this point, that it is important for children to learn the language and songs and culture and nature of their country so they can stay on their country and live on it and care for it and grow it up so they have somewhere to live in the future. And she's very happy to share that knowledge with anybody else, anywhere else in Australia, because she recognises just how valuable that thing is, that it was a free gift from the ancestors, and it's her responsibility, and this is typical of her noble intentions, to pass that on to the children for free.
Can they do that, learn all of that, look after country, learn their language and culture without white man's education? Can they do it just by staying on homeland and being taught by old people like Bainwanga?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, there's no reason at all that anybody needs to be able to speak English in a place where nobody does speak English. It's not the language of the country and nobody there speaks it. You certainly can't name anything in English. There aren't any English names for things. So there's no reason to have English. I suppose one of the things that our settler society believes and assumes to be true is that it's necessary to speak English. Whereas we've seen in so many other countries all around the world, most people don't speak English and yet are able to carry on perfectly civilized lives. So not only is it not necessary to speak English, it's more usual anywhere else in the world for people to speak a number of languages. Ours is one of the most monolingual cultures in the world, and we're the poorer for it because we don't understand the learning of language and the value that learning the language of learning gives to a young learner. So, for example, in bilingual education, it is understood by everyone else in the world, except the Northern Territory, apparently, that bilingual education provides much better learning than English-only education. And one of the things that came out of the recent destruction of bilingual education is that after 1 year of teaching children in English only, the outcomes for children between 3 and 5 years old dropped 89%. So if children weren't getting proper education and relevant education before they went to English-only teaching, they most certainly weren't getting it after they went to English-only education.
Mm. The education system has a lot to answer for. NAPLAN, then. NAPLAN is a form of measuring the outcomes and achievements of young people in the education system. Is that the case?
Well, what
are your thoughts?
Says.
Yes.
And that's the thing the rest of the society assumes to be true. That's what's said, for example, in a newspaper. But if you look at what it does measure, NAPLAN shows the unrecognised level of racism in the country. Where is it going to be fair or useful to race children from Melbourne Grammar in a race of English against kids from Ramagining Outstation where they don't speak English at all and there is no need for it? What does it show other than there is some strange and perverse care for English only at the expense of life and, of course, the healthy outcomes of the children in the bush? It's a very, very strongly anti-education tool, in fact. What NAPLAN does is very bad for young people in the bush and perhaps makes the wider society feel better about having told the big lie story.
Mm. Yeah, it's not all that much better for young people, particularly First Nations people in cities.
Mm.
City schools and stuff, yeah. Now, homelands situation, the languages. This dictionary, the Yanangu language, the dictionary, how many people speak this language now?
Well, now only 15 people speak the Yanangu language, but The dictionary also has the words of the Kupapingo, Jambarpingo or Dualduala language, the Yulungumatta language of northeast Arnhem Land, which includes some 7,000 speakers, and of course the English words as well. So it's a good tool for bilingual education. And of course it's typical of Bamaranga to want to give that for free to the children. So the tool teaches not only the different languages, but the tools of learning. So it helps people understand better. To triangulate, there's a nice three-lettered word, to triangulate the ideas between languages as well as the language learning itself. So it gives much better learning outcomes. The homelands are the last place in Australia where languages are truly spoken. So in the 500 homelands in the Northern Territory, where the last 100 very strong, small Indigenous languages are still spoken, the government has moved a thing called the Stronger Futures, perhaps Stronger Futures for Mining might be a better name, to link parents' income to children's attendance at school. So if your children don't go to a school, you can be fined and eventually jailed. But the important thing is that the children are moved off the homelands and away from the old people and those people with knowledge about country who know the names of the sites and the words of the language. So it breaks the chain of the intergenerational transmission of the deep ecological and cultural knowledge, songs, art, ways of being and kinship with country. So for those 500 homelands, and the 10,000 people that they service, part of the 40,000-strong Indigenous population of the Northern Territory, who are one-third of the population, their rights to be able to speak their language or live on their country and all of those things, which internationally Australia stands up and trumpets about how much it cares for, domestically are destroyed. And the government comes up with excuses about how it hasn't any money to spend on it and those kinds of things, or that it's better for people. It's part of the lie story, that Indigenous people don't deserve to be able to have their country. That's why it's okay for the settlers to take it.
So the Northern Territory intervention is what you've just said is reinforcing and confirming what a lot of our people have said, First Nations people in the Northern Territory, that the Northern Territory intervention is a form of cultural genocide.
Absolutely, no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it at all. When I was living in Gapawiyak and the intervention started, before the army rolled into town in one of the most revolting territory, and since they gave people houses, I beg your pardon, police stations and not houses, which they didn't ask for police stations, but they got police stations anyway, the incarceration rate has gone up 46%. And 82% of people in jail in the Northern Territory are of Indigenous descent, mostly for misdemeanours. So letters come to a post service that doesn't exist, to a letterbox that doesn't exist, in a language that no one speaks, saying that you must appear in court because your child has been fined for not going to school to participate in an irrelevant education system. And eventually the police will find you and put you in jail, and you won't even know why. But
it's a damn joke. This is a damn joke. I've got a caller on the line, Bentley. Merv. Merv, what would you like to say?
Yeah, you were talking about they don't want to, you know, they shouldn't have to learn English, but it's only for their own protection because around the world, like the Indians, all these other places and that, people walk in there and if they don't understand any English, they could get them to sign away their land to the mining companies or whoever and everything else like that. And when I travelled across your country, the First Nation country there, there was always someone, it didn't matter how far in the desert or right across the Broome or anywhere across the Western Australia from the back of Ayers Rock right down to South Australia, there was always someone that learned English. And that's the one thing, you know, that they were really you know, they ask you about this and that, different words they didn't know, you know.
I hear what you say. Because, I hear what you say.
They could get trapped to selling away everything, you know.
Let's hear what my guest...
There's got to be, you know, there's got to be someone, maybe someone in each little group, you know, like an elder or something like that, or, you know, a young one coming through, can learn English so he can translate, so they don't get trapped into just signing away, putting their mark and say, well... Hooray, you've got to go.
No worries, mate. We'll see what our guest has to say. But he said earlier, he did say earlier that they're living in a place where there is no English spoken, where there is nothing of the white system in this environment. Well, let's see what he says. Thanks for your call, Thanks for your call. We'll hear what our guest has to, my guest has to say. Thank you, Merv. What are your thoughts there?
Yes, I heard what Merv said, and thank you, Merv. And it is a good question. I do think that there is a sense in which where we live now, English has become very much a part of the way we live. And that has to do with the way our history has run out, same as it had in India, where people's lives and country were taken over by the British. Bemadwanga, for example, doesn't speak any English at all, and yet... she is the most virtuous, kindly and generous person you could possibly imagine. Also, there is nobody who I have met in Northeast Arnhem Land or in the desert at Yuendumu or anywhere in the country who is a countryman that does not know that the government system is about trying to take their land and sea and take their resources. Bemadwanga knows that perfectly well.
Without being able to speak English. Without speaking English, she knows perfectly well.
She doesn't speak a word of English. Mm. But every Indigenous person I've ever spoken to, without a single difference, has all known that this system is designed to be able to expropriate their resources to make the settler culture rich. That's what happened in the past. That's what's happening now. Some people call it post-colonialism. Certainly, it's going on today. And the intervention is a very powerful example of just that kind of thing. Merv's idea about English speaking is strong in that it is important that people in the situation where they have been taken over, like we are in Australia, do learn to speak the majority language. There's nothing wrong with that at all. And Indigenous people worldwide are very good at being able to learn second, third and fourth languages. And I think it's a marvellous idea if people get to learn English, but not at the expense of their own language. And that is a critical issue. By destroying people's language and pretending that you can only get along by speaking this one or that one is a terrible ethnocidal and very strongly dangerous and immoral way of behaving in the world.
Yes. You put it well. Hence the term for the Minister for Faxia, Macklin. Minister Macklin, I often regard her as Genocide Jenny, because she is responsible for legislation that is causing cultural genocide. Now... you must find yourself, you as Dr. Bentley James, anthropologist and linguist, taught Whitefellow Way based on science, and now you've just spent 20 years with this old lady that's such an amazing woman. And you spent longer than that with First Nations people, learning their ways, knowing their ways, learning their languages. You must find yourself in, I don't know, having to code switch. I mean, you're taught different things based on science, yet there is conflicting views or quite the opposite happening from a First Nations perspective. What do you say to that?
Well, yes, code switching is probably a good way to talk about it, because there are times at which I have to think, for example, if I'm writing something, I might have to think in an academic way. But there is... values in our society and ways of living in the world that are beyond simple intellectualization. Just being smart means very little if you can't live as a real human being. If you're not related, if you're not generous and kind and live with virtue and a sense of your place and the place of the people around you with care, then what's so what, you have credentials, or so what, you know something. You know nothing if you can't live in a way in the world that isn't generous and kindly and thoughtful and joyful. And that's the way that Bemaruanga teaches to live, by example. She is just wonderful to be around. She's the happiest, most delightful person you could possibly imagine. And she doesn't have any degrees at all of any kind, doesn't speak a word of English, but her conversation is lively and brilliant and caring and thoughtful and generous and interesting. She knows so much about the world. I think there was a documentary about her life in which they said, a young fellow who was making the documentary said that she had more knowledge than any professor in any university, which is a terribly powerful understatement. What she has understood and forgotten is more than all the universities hold. And the key to all of this is this idea of relatedness to country and people, this sustainable, generous way of living with the people around you and the country that you live in. Because the countrymen look after country. The landowners that are trying to come in, as they did in the colonial day, and use the police and the politicians to tell a lie story as to why people should hand over the country, no one believes all that. That's all silly business. Living in a good way on the country, that is the thing that countrymen do so brilliantly, and Bemaruanga does that beautifully. So I find myself in a strange position, knowing that everything I think I know about science and kinship and systems and anthropology or linguistics or education or media are meaningless in a place where being together and learning to live together are everything. So, yes, I code switch a lot.
What would you say to particularly my mob, but all mob? We all call this place home. We can all learn about quality of life and what it means, what real living is about. What would you say? What's some advice? What's some of the things that we could be doing? What should we be focusing on?
Well, I'm very, very not the one to be handing out advice. As you probably know, I'm just a fellow. But I have been in the company of one of the wisest persons I've ever seen. And
what would she say?
I think Big Boss would probably say that being kind to each other is a key idea. We need to up the kindness. We have to be generous and gentle to the place that we live and the people around us, aware of the spirits of the country that we stand on, that we live on, making those things the things that we think about, and perhaps not so much the material object.
Mm. Where to with the dictionary? When will it be out in the hands of community people, schools, young ones?
We're working day and night. We're doing as quickly as we can, but we're a team of very few people, and so we're working away as best as we can to get it done before Big Boss's 97th birthday. So next year in June, we're hoping to have it go to print sometime before June next year, and then to be able to distribute it to the children of the homelands and the schools and some of their parents and the institutions in different communities, so that all of those people have an opportunity to have the dictionary as a bilingual, trilingual resource, but also to read Bemaruanga's story and see something of the way that she has lived in the Crocodile Islands for nearly 100 years.
And when does this old lady turn 97? What month is that?
In June.
In June, okay.
Yes, but she's not absolutely certain it's in June. It's just that that's how it's been recorded.
Yeah.
And so June it is.
How relevant?
On the island of Murunga.
All right. In the Crocodile Islands.
Yeah.
How relevant is this dictionary to people on the East Coast? Black fellas like myself, white fellas? How relevant is it? Is it important? Is it important to all people?
I think so. I think the symbol of the dictionary, the idea that it's about people's link to country and valuing difference, location-based difference, the locality in which this one person and her group of people and their history and their valuable knowledge linked to that place in thousands of generations of intimate coexistence gives a particular picture of the world of that place. And no other picture can replace that picture. And so in all of the other places around Australia, there are secret knowledges and names and places and ways of knowing and being. And the people that have those have a responsibility to pass on and keep precious those knowledges, because the rest of the knowledge that comes, you know, from overseas is really rather meaningless and has nothing to do with the essence of Australia or the thing that it is to be Australian. You know, there's Britain and there's America and there's those places. But they are not Australia, and what they want over there, I should imagine, are different things.
This dictionary, it's more than just words. Tell us what else, maps and things, illustrations?
Yes, it has the very good fortune of being in, over the years, there's a number of anthropologists and linguists and people who visited the Crocodile Islands. So in 1924, a man called Sir Hubert Wilkins, who was Australia's most famous explorer that we've never heard of, who won three ticker tape parades in New York in the early 20s and 30s for his amazing journeys under the ice cap to the South Pole in a submarine that he bought from the Russians after the First World War for a dollar, and flying across the South Pole and then having to land his plane and walk out. He was named the bravest man in Australia by the Prime Minister on winning the Victoria Cross for filming the war in the trenches in the First World War from a biplane. And that film still exists. So that marvellous man spent a year in Milindimbi, Sir Hubert Wilkins, and when he left, he said that Australia is the poorest rich country in the world because of the way it treats its indigenous people. And so there's been a 100-year media ban on him, unfortunately. So he made beautiful photographs of the Crocodile Islands, which will be in the dictionary. So to Lloyd Warner, who was an anthropologist from America who lived on the Crocodile Islands from 1926 to 29, who wrote one of the most formative and important ethnographies in anthropology that was an absolute classic from that's around the world, that sparked the imaginations of European and scholars throughout the world. From 1937, when it was published, to 1965, I think, until Kin and Conflict came out by Les Hyatt. I think he popped Warner off there. He took beautiful photographs. They'll be in the dictionary. The wonderful Donald Thompson, who was Australia's most important ever ethnographer, who took beautiful photographs of people. In fact, he photographed Baimaruanga at Gadatta at Murunga Island in April in 1937. That photograph will be in the dictionary. But all of the photographs of the wonderful people that have visited and made a contribution to our understanding of the world will have their photographs in the dictionary as well, so people can see the line of history of the time since the mission and, you know, other people came along.
If people want to make contact with you, talk about the dictionary, support, assist where they can, how can people make contact?
There's a website called the Crocodile Islands Rangers, and that's the website that talks about, it has videos of Baimaruanga doing work and making fish traps. In fact, one of the fish traps on the island of Murunga that she made in 1937, where her husband and father were photographed by Thompson, she has remade in 2010 to teach the children the skills of fish trap making and some of the lore of the island. So if you go to www.crocodileislandsrangers, one word, all lowercase, you can see it there. And there's information there about the dictionary and videos of Baimaruanga and the Ranger Project and the Yanangu Ecological Knowledges Database and Language Nests and so forth, the other projects that Baimaruanga's been running.
Very good. Well, Dr. Bentley James, we've come to the end of the program. The news will start in a minute or so. I do appreciate your time, your wealth of knowledge. Oh, it's just fantastic. Great to spend the hour talking to you, I tell you. Thank you very much for your time.
Tiger, thank you, and continue as you have been as a wonderful champion for all that's right in this country. Thank you. It was a pleasure to meet you years ago. It was great to speak to you again. Thank you very much.
We will talk again, and you keep up the great work. Thank you very much. Have a good day. And there was Dr. Bentley James, anthropologist and linguist, working with Baimawanga, Laurie Baimawanga, 96-year-old, First Nations woman, Senior Australian of the Year, 2012. An amazing woman. And Bentley James is working on the Yanangu language, a dictionary of the Yanangu people's language up there. Of the Crocodile Islands. So you can go to that website, Crocodile Islands Rangers. So Crocodile Islands Rangers, all one word, lowercase. You can go to that website and follow that through. So 6 months or so, they hope to have that dictionary released and out in the hands of particularly those Mobbin homelands and people up there. Great to see. Great to hear. Karen Durant, he is hosting tomorrow's program. So we'll see you again. Have a great day. We'll talk again.